The fact that the M2 is collapsing, the fact that lending is collapsing, the fact that the delinquencies is rising, the fact that the job market is actually normalizing much faster than people think, and everyone is spending their bottom dollar on the Magic 4 now, right? And or the Magic 7, and everybody has the same trade on. The point here is that the market is not liquid enough. There is not enough bids. If we have 2 days of 5% down moves, then we're going to accelerate to minus 30%.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. Markets seem pretty convinced that 2024 is experiencing, in the words of U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, a soft landing. But what if everyone's wrong? And if they are wrong, which assets are cheap right now, and what will happen to the markets? Steen Jacobsen, Chief Economist and Chief Investment Officer of Saxo Bank, has been pointedly asking these questions of late. And today, we're going to hear what he thinks the answers are. Steen, it's wonderful to see you again, my friend. Thanks for working late at your office in Copenhagen to speak with us.
It's an absolute pleasure, Adam. Always there for you, and hopefully I can give one or two insights from a European's perspective here.
Oh, my goodness. I'm sure you can give a lot more than just one or two. And yes, so you are sitting there in Europe. We have, you know, the majority of the audience that watches these videos is US-based, but we do have a lot of people from elsewhere in the world. We've had a number of them recently saying, hey, Adam, can you bring on somebody who can give more of an outside of the US perspective? So I do want to actually talk with you about what you see there from your perch in Europe, and specifically if there's anything going on in Europe, development-wise, trend-wise, that you think is important for investors to keep their eyes on. Real quick, though, lots to get through here, limited amount of time. Let's kick it off with the question, what's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Well, we are very much in what I call the juicing of the system trend right now. And what I talk about here is, of course, is the election cycle in the US. It's pretty clear to me that the establishment. The establishment is clearly on a path, which is that they want to secure that the incumbent voters around the world. And don't forget, it's not only the US who goes to the polls this year. It's roughly 50% of the world's voters that have to be in the polls and giving their votes. I mean, including, ironically, Russia. But let's put that to one side. But India is another really important one. We have South Africa. We have a number of Belgium. We have probably Europe in terms of UK before the end of it. And I think when you look at these systems with a bit of a cynical operative model like I do, I think they're all up to just making sure the numbers. I think we could, I don't want to, but we can talk about the labor market data, which is just ironically and truthfully, you know, we should get away from even reporting non-farm payrolls. They have a revision of 50% month to month. On top of that, this month, for instance, we have 353 new jobs. But the reality is that actually we actually lost jobs, both in terms of the non-farm, but also in terms of the household survey. But because we normally have less job in January, then it was actually a plus. And to be honest, Adam, I come from a world where one plus one is two. So I have some difficulties with these seasonality and the concept that I'm going to do my investment based on these data. And I think that's the functional part of the world, that we're in a world where data doesn't matter. The equity market is playing monopoly. And this monopoly game is really just, geared towards news by news story that we see on a daily basis. It is very much in terms of trading focused on zero-day options and the ability of over earnings report to buy, you know, a call for the next day. If you're right, you make a lot of money and you make a big move like you saw with Meta. You know, in a rational world, Meta shouldn't be, you know, 20% different in value one day before and after an actual announcement. The majority of what went on there was that he's got some control over the employment, relatively speaking, and seeing some success in AI. But he's in the bracket of basically being in telecom and in marketing. And marketing, I don't think, is going to be a huge success going forward.
Oh, my goodness, Steen. All right. So you gave me a lot to react to there. I actually didn't realize that 50% of the world's voters are going to have to cast a ballot this year. That's a big deal. From our perch here in the U.S., it seems like the rest of the world is becoming, trying to get the right term, more nationalistic. You know, that we're seeing the desire for globalism and holding hands with the rest of the world and humanity. That seems to be getting sacrificed as more populists are saying, hey, look, we got a lot of problems here at home. We want to elect people that are going to take care of our problems first. Are you seeing the same from where you are?
Absolutely. And it's kind of ironic that the playbook for all this is actually Putin's playbook. Putin's playbook says that you have to be a strong man. You have to be a strong man to cater for the average voter, for the voter who is in doubt. So what is the one common denominator from the US and across the globe and all the election that we saw in 23 and we will see in 24, and even going all the way back to Trump's first election and the Brexit in the UK, the fact is that people are not really voting for a person they like. They're voting for a person who they perceive to be one that can defend the so-called, in citation mark, values of our society. In the case of the US, you know, the American dream, the ability of, making your own money independent of the state, sort of the broader lines of that. In Europe, it is, you know, maintaining the social status, having a reasonable society inside this social democratic sort of version of society that we created in Europe and which is working well. So the point here is that every single election of the 50% that goes will be driven by whoever has the strongest voice, who raises his voice there or hers voice the loudest. We saw it in Italy, we saw it in Argentina, we saw it in Brazil, we saw it certainly in the Netherlands, where we had a huge swing to the far right. So the voices of the far right and to some extent the far left are strong because they are single issue voices. These single issue voices makes the sort of translating of the message that these politicians have very simple. And they are all of them catering to the worst of human beings. They're all going on the scary part of your sort of psychology and the way you think about the world. So, you know, I think it's super, super interesting to see that the model that Putin adopted in the early 2000s is actually the model that's being adopted by every single politician in the world. Come out with a strong voice, be single issue in terms of what you're trying to do, but forget about vision, forget about what it actually means for the economy, and totally forget about what the rest of the world thinks of you.
All right, interesting. So, you know, I've spent a lot of time on this program of late talking about the growing wealth divide here in the U.S. and how, and I know it's happening in a lot of other countries as well, where the populace, particularly the middle class, you know, the one that's really sort of the engine of the economy, increasingly beginning to lose faith in the promise, right, in the American dream, if you live here in the U.S. You know, I've talked a lot about kind of the corrosive and pernicious implications of that. You know, you're basically saying that is making its way into the voter booth, and people are looking for the strong man who's promising that he's going to try to attend to their needs around that, their pain around that. You know, in Europe, you've had Brexit, you've had rumors of all sorts of other exits, you know, in the European Union. Do you expect to see more of that in the future? The schism of the larger you know, cooperative elements that have been being built over the past couple of decades, the European Union being just one good example of that. And I guess where I'm going with this is does that then manifest itself in trade? I'm trying to figure out how this will impact the economy down the road.
First of all, the major impact is that rightly as you say, the sort of the real return on capital, the real return on social investments are negative. Because in nominal terms, it would look like you have a growth. You have the government, in the case of the US, spending a huge amount of money, but they're doing it increasingly in the public sector. And what you're getting for $1 spent in the public sector is significantly less than $1 output. So in other words, you're really just borrowing from the future in terms of crowding out the private capital, you're crowding out the everything. So that will make for the socially sort of unequal person things even worse, because it's actually diluting your ability to have social migration. It's diluting certainly your ability to get education because of the cost of it, and the sort of getting to the goal of where you want to be with your life and your vision is getting longer and harder. The other part is that, and then we see that, and I'm not going to comment specifically about the woke movement, but the woke movement to me is clearly predicated on the fact that the biggest inequality we have in the world is between the youth and our generation, Adam. Our generation and the ones that came before that, they benefited from buying a one-bedroom apartment, then moving to a two-bedroom, buying a detached house, buying a summer house. So we sort of rode sort of the ever lower interest rate, the ever lower inflation, and we benefited in terms of how we created our wealth. If you want, and if you were 22 years old today and look with the wisdom of you and me, there's really only one way to reach for the stars in terms of the assets that you can buy. And that is why crypto and similar sort of investment vehicles becomes interesting, because they are the only sort of instruments that offers the hope of getting on to what I call the climbing up the ladder socially. So these are deep-rooted problems, and all of them sort of goes back to the same fact that we live in a society that until very recently had zero productivity. That zero productivity is predicated, again, on the fact that we had very low interest rates and no accountability in terms of how we spend our money. Productivity, you know, put in a different way. Economics, if you reduce it to two variables that really matters, is demographics. We know where the demographics component goes over time. And the other one is productivity. Due to the very high inflation that we talked about 2 and 3 years ago, we actually got high marginal cost of capital. The higher the marginal capital goes in terms of cost, the more productivity you need to facilitate actually getting access to that capital. So we are in a period where, you know, people will see it as AI, but I see it as productivity now is really gaining. The only way companies, the only way individuals can actually compete going forward is if they can offer productivity. So Adam, we sit in political cycle and socioeconomic cycle. We are in what I call the ninth inning of pretend and extend, pretending we have integrity and a model, and extending by buying time. And that's what 24 is about. And why is 24 about that? 24 is about it because we have elections. So you have all of these sort of sinus cycles coinciding in 24. The establishment needs low interest rates, which will make the central banks more prone to cut interest rate relatively to a normal business cycle and independently on the growth as well. And you have that the politician needs to be seen as being acting, which means that they're going to be fiscally spending. And then on the other side of this comes that we probably said, and this is the positive news, we probably said in front of the most productive 25 years in history. Why? Because the marginal cost of energy due to AI, due to the ability of science through AI, big data, to control something like fusion energy, to make nuclear powers more available in a smaller scale, similar to what we see in nuclear submarines. So the cost of energy, which is the single biggest cost to society, is coming down massively, not because of the new sort of found resources, but simply because the world needs a more productive world. To get a more productive world, we need the cost of energy to go down, and that will force investment into this new area. So I know it's a long answer, but it is very important to me to understand, to make everyone understand. These are cycles who are coinciding. So they all have their individual cycle, socioeconomics, monetary policy, elections and everything else. But they all come together in 24 on a kind of a low. But from that low, we were sort of almost like Phoenix rise from the ashes.
Okay, I like that you ended there on a note of positivity. So we'll talk about that in a second. Although, of course, if it gets to ashes, the process of it getting to ashes isn't going to be very fun. All right, so many points to dig into here. Let me ask you this. So if I heard you correctly, we have been. We have enjoyed a prolonged period of time where our productivity got lower and lower and lower, but we didn't really have to pay the piper because the cost of capital was held so low. In fact, probably artificially for a very long time by the central banks. COVID and the supply chain breakages and then the stimulus response to that let the inflation genie out of the bottle. And when you have low productivity slam into higher cost of capital, that's where sort of you see everybody's been, you see who's been swimming naked, right? And so we've got to get productivity up. And you talked about that's probably why AI is being so heavily invested in right now. But you said something that I'm trying to square in my mind here, which is we have a need to get inflation back down again, right? The central planners, everybody wants low inflation here to mitigate our low productivity and just to, you know, it's hard to run our overleveraged economies when cost of capital is this high. So we've got this need for low inflation, but as you said, the politicians have stepped in to quote unquote do something. And we've got this tremendous fiscal spending going on right now in the US, and I also believe in a number of European countries as well. And I've asked recently on this channel, given the fact that the fiscal spenders have really dialed the fiscal spending up to 11 now, you know, they've really brought it up to maximum, and it's become business as usual, can they turn that dial back down? Is the political appetite there for a politician to stand up and say, well, we know we've been giving you a lot of excess, you know, liquidity here and whatnot, and now it's time for us to tighten our belts, and it's going to hurt a little bit everybody, but we want to do this for the greater good. I don't think there's a politician in America that would be willing to do that, I'd say. So can those two things be squared? Because you can't bring inflation down if you keep spending this much forever on the fiscal side.
No, that's what classic economics will tell you. But as I alluded to before, what you need to understand is that fiscal spend, the value in terms of output is negative to a large extent, or at least for every dollar, it's only worth about 40 cents. Mm-hmm. So as you crowd it out, as you ramp up the spend you have, you're actually getting, due to the size of it mathematically, you're getting less and less output for it. So if it's 40% today, it will be 20% in 1 year's time. So in itself, that momentum is sort of short-circuited by the fact that there are no real output to it. You know, government jobs is not going to, you know, more RIS revenue officers is not going to save the America's productivity, right? So that's the one thing. The other thing is the markets. You know, I think pretty clearly the market told us when we were trading 425, 430 in the early parts of summer last year, the market was telling you for the first time probably since World War II that the U.S. government cannot continue without a plan for what's going to happen to the fiscal deficit. Does that mean, going to your question, that the government is willing and able to do that? Certainly not in an election year, but down the road, the market will discipline them, because the alternative here is, as you say, is that we flip to the other side of the low interest rate, high productivity. We flip to a world where basically you need 6-7% to attract investors ultimately. So the market, the bond market, in my opinion, above 4.5-5% will totally slow down the U.S. economy. Imagine we go, which some people are calling for now, a little bit of reemergence of inflation and Fed staying high for longer. The only thing that will happen is that makes the totality of the incoming recession deeper. So they are, you know, there are pros and cons in terms of how it works. There are opposite forces at work here. But the two driving forces of why it will not be able to continue is simply the output per input dollar in terms of fiscal deficit is coming down. So, you know, they can spend as much money they want. It will have to be the private sector that picks up. You know, a great live example to that is the Chinese economy. I know it's pretty unfair to the U.S. compared to the U.S., but what the Chinese economy got is a huge amount of a public sector. As they have disallowed the private sector to actually operate, you've seen what happened to the stock market, you've seen what happened to growth, you've seen what happened to inflation. That is sort of your worst case scenario. Obviously, that sits an American model that most people think is vibrant and lively. I often get asked, you know, how can you defend capitalism when things doesn't work? We don't have capitalism. I mean, think about Japan, the third largest economy in the world. They don't have discovery of money. discovery of money is the market setting the price of money. I mean, it's the Japanese government, the third largest economy in the world. Basically, in the US right now, you have almost the same because you have the huge amount of issues that you address in your question. And at the same time, you don't have enough demand from the banking sector because you put onerous sort of demands on the banks in terms of new capital, the Basel III is getting introduced. Money market funds has picked up the slack, but they are now reversing it down. So when we come into March, the one of the two scenarios I have is that, you know, in March, we're really going to test the limits because liquidity goes out of the market and the fiscal impulse, everything being equal, cannot be as big as it was last year. Last year, we added, you know, huge 5.5% nominal growth from the fiscal deficit. This year is probably going to be minus, not because the necessarily because the nominal amount spent is down, but simply because when you do like for like comparison in real term, in terms of impulse, it becomes negative.
Okay. Boy, my challenge here is going to be trying to get as many of these questions that I have here for you packed into the time that we have, and I'm probably not going to get to all of them, but you just provided a really good segue into your recent piece here, a chronicle of yours that you've written titled Given Two Options, Then Take the Third. So you basically said, look, there's a lot of things that could happen this year, but you focused on the two trajectories that you think have the highest likelihood of happening, one of which you've titled the Everyone is Wrong trajectory, which basically I believe is, okay, what if everybody who says we're going to have a soft landing or even no landing, which has now become the dominant narrative, what if they're all wrong? The second one is titled It's All About the Election, Stupid. And I assume that's sort of just the central planners will throw everything plus the kitchen sink at keeping things supported up until the November elections here in the US or whatever domestic election is happening in whatever country. Can you just give us a brief description of each one of those trajectories, why you think it's got some of the highest probability of happening? And then in each case, you say, well, okay, if this is what's going to happen, this is what's cheap right now. And this is what you think is going to happen to the market. So let's dive into those two things too.
Yeah, so let's go with the one with, I end the note saying, I think the it's about the election, stupid, that will drive at least Q1. And as we said in the middle of Q1, you know, what I said beginning of the year was that, you know, in a market that where equity is treated like it's monopoly money, and then where we don't really, you know, take any account between the economy and the market itself, it's an animal to itself, the stock market. And if you have the central planners, as you call them, being very, very conducive to and very, they have a high propensity to cut interest rate. You can even see it in the interview in 60 Minutes by Powell that he's not even closing out the, he's not even closing the door on a March cut because he's looking for any softness in the data to just go ahead and actually do the cut. Why? Because, you know, they want to induce the system. They want to make sure that the liquidity is ample. They want to make sure that the inflation is on a downward trajectory. And they have a major issue. The major issue they have is that real rates in the U.S. is sitting between 2.5% and 3% positive. The U.S. has not seen positive real rates in 10 years. So the cost of capital, going back to sort of the real cost of capital, is massive. You know, most companies that need to raise capital in bank loans needs to pay 8-9%. These are not the rates you see when you look at the 10-year. This is not the rate you see in the SOFA contract. These are real money. That's also why, as we sit here today, the stock market in terms of S&P and NASDAQ is up, but Russell 2000 is down. Russell 2000 is have an R-square with 10-year notes yields of 95%. It's all about the interest rate cost. So for the financial conditions are easy, everyone says. No, they're not. Financial conditions is measured in terms of the S&P 500. S&P 500 is really, it used to be 7 stocks, now it's really 4. So every measurement we have, Adam, on this is really sending the wrong signals relatively to what is the underlying story. Go to any businessman, and I'm sure you do, you know, in even in California, go to these guys. They're having issues in terms of cost of wages. They have in terms of energy cost. They have in terms of, you know, government intervention, certainly in the state of California on green. All these things that they need to comply with. It's just a massive uphill struggle for them. And in that sense, that scenario needs to be met by what? Lower interest rates. So if you have too high real rates, and you know, and this is one of my, that's my really only strong conviction, we are going to see less than 2% inflation in the US by the year end. And if that is the case, and Fed is sitting around not cutting interest rate, real rates would go from 2.5 to 3 to 3.25, and that will kill the economy. So you have, in one shape or form here, you have the fact, well, whatever happens, if Fed stays too long, they will kill the economy even before the election. If Fed then have the excuse to go, they will go. What would that do to the stock market? Everyone will give you the data. You know, it's an election year. It's always good. If January is up, everything is up. All this stuff that really has nothing to do with science, but is all, you know, you could just as well go on the race course to play with this kind of data. But that's what the market believes in. That's the number one. That's sort of the, it's about the elections.
Hey, can I ask you one question about that? So there's a lag effect to monetary policy, right? And many folks like myself have been saying, hey, we've got to be careful that there's still the lag effect from all the rate hikes that we haven't fully felt yet. Even if the Fed were to cut, say, in March, given the lag effect, we wouldn't really necessarily see the benefits of those cuts by the election, would we? I mean, could the Fed actually raise rates in a way that would cushion the economy before the election, or is it running out of time to do so?
Excellent point. And of course not. But the stock market will preempt the move. So, and we were talking about what it will mean for assets. So the initial reaction for the stock market would be for the stock market to rally. I do think that after that comes the fact when we have this compounding of the high interest rates. I mean, and we know it's happening because if we look at bank loans lending, it's now zero. If bank lending loans go to minus 5%, which is very likely year over year, it equates to taking $250 billion out of the system. So we are in a system where liquidity is coming out at the same time as the financial conditions are too tight, if you measure it correctly. These two things combined means that it's probably very likely that we have a two halves this year. We have the first quarter, which already looks to be excellent. Then in March, we see the liquidity drain. Then in June, July, August, the central planners is going to panic. And then we're going to see a huge amount of liquidity provision. We probably see a retirement or part retirement of the QT to sort of adjust the system to be operating. The other part is that, and this is probably much easier to explain now. The other thing that everybody's wrong is, of course, I've been in this business for over 30 years. I never had a definition of soft landing. So if you can give me one, what a soft landing looks like, I'll be very happy to get it. But what will most likely happen, you know, from, I just gave you my trader's view. Now my economist view comes here. You know, the compounding effect, the fact that the M2 is collapsing, the fact that lending is collapsing, the fact that the delinquencies is rising, the fact that the job market is actually normalizing much faster than people think. It's not still very tight. It's actually getting to a point where it's getting nervous. If you look at the war notices, if you look at the announcement just on a daily basis of company laying off people, it's big and it's accelerating. But the concept here is that if everyone, and everyone is betting their bottom dollar on the magic four now, right? And or the magic seven, and everybody has the same trade on. The point here is that the market is not liquid enough. There is not enough bids. If we have 2 days of 5% down moves, then we're going to accelerate to minus 30% without the central bank stepping in. And that's where they will step in. So constantly this year, we're going to be between, you know, what the markets from sort of the gravitation of the economic laws will do and what the central planners will try to avoid. That is the fight that you as an investor this year, Adam, needs to take. And my take on that is really, well, okay, I'm just going to take 5% either in cash or bonds and do the roles and probably, you know, commercial, some of the better commercial CLO loans are effective. I think 24 is a waiting game because these two opposing forces are so strong, the central planners versus the compounded impact of all the policy we've done wrong over the course of the last 4 years. I mean, the worst being that we overstimulated when we did the reopening. But in net effect, it doesn't really matter. We are still in the sort of aftermath of what COVID did to the world. It accelerated the problem. COVID actually, in that respect, did us a favor because we got to this point faster than we would have been. We have higher marginal cost of capital. It's good for productivity going forward. But it also means that the system needs to be cleaned out a bit before we can move on.
All right. The system needs to be cleaned out a bit. So I basically, if I took notes correctly here, you think that it's all about the election stupid scenario. Central planners throwing in the kitchen sink, making sure everything looks great. That's going to be the theme for the rest of kind of Q1 here. When we get into March, you think we get into some rocky periods. Then maybe perhaps the everyone is wrong playbook begins to kick in. And then at some point when the Fed realizes that, or the other world central banks realize that, then they rush to the rescue. And I don't know, I guess, what do we see? We see damage in the economy from what they're trying to do, but do we see juiced asset prices again too?
Probably not, because as you can see with the small banks, we've seen recently that real estate is becoming an issue, not only in the New York bank that is, you know, again today is up 15%, but you saw Deutsche Bank in terms of their U.S. properties taking a huge loss. You saw the Japanese banks taking a huge loss in U.S. properties. So as you rightly say, this is a fuse, a very long fuse that's been ignited there, Adam. But it's slowly moving. But in the meantime, everyone is having a party on the top deck, you know, seeing nothing but clear sailing in terms of what goes on, because we're going to have a magic soft landing, and Fed is going to be sitting by the wayside and just be willing to get up and help the market. That's how the market thinks. The overcalculus or the wrong assumption here could be, as you indicate for your question, that goes out of control. You know, Fed doesn't normally cut interest rate because of the economic data, because we have not allowed a business cycle to work since the LTCM intervention in 98. So it's normally in 9 out of 10 times, at least in my counting, they've done it because there was an illiquidity event in the market. It could be the small banks again becoming an issue. It could be that the treasury market doesn't have the ability to take the offering that comes from treasury in terms of the deficit. There's a number of factors that can do it. The point is that all roads here leads to not to Rome, but to the fact that there needs to be more intervention. And this is all framed by the fact that real rates is way, way too high, and Fed knows it. Fed knows that it's too high. Fed is not looking at non-farm payroll. They're looking at the beige book, the reporting from the local central banks in the Federal Reserve System. More than 50% is reporting that they have negative growth rates. They have rising unemployment. They have problems with the system. Fed is taking notice of this. And don't forget, sometimes you need to look at the CV of these policymakers. Powell comes from credit. He comes from the private equity side. He knows when things comes to a standstill. That's when he gets the reporting. The reason we saw the pivot in November from Powell was the reporting in the base book and the fact that we were starting to get a standstill in commercial real estate. We're starting to see the bank lending collapsing. That's the point they're looking for. Now they're looking for an excuse to deviate and get away from what they perceive to be their biggest risk, that they are loosening too fast. But I think the risk here is that they are overstaying their tightness, because relatively speaking, we should have a gradual reduction of interest rate. We may need a very aggressive loosening where we see two times 50 basis points to start it off. Yeah, it may not be in March. It may not even be in May. But if it comes in June, I will almost guarantee you it needs to be 50 in June and 50 in July.
Okay. And this is, What you're describing there would be very consistent with history, right? When we look at the past several recessions, they have followed a rate hike progression. Usually rates kind of stall out or hang out at a plateau for a while. And then the Fed realizes, oh gosh, we stayed too high for too long. And then the rate cuts tend to happen on a
And
waterfall where
classically
escalator up,
GDP
elevator
normal,
down.
yeah, and classically nominal GDP peaks just before the economy moves to recession. There's
Right.
nothing unusual in this
As does the stock market
environment,
too.
as does the stock market. There's nothing unusual. It's like everybody talks to me like I'm an idiot, and we've never been here before, and I need to understand this is a new way of seeing the market, like the third way I talk about. You know, there isn't a third way, as I push back on in the note as well. There is only two ways. You need to be productive to, you know, the most productive stocks in the world makes the biggest amount of money. That's a fact, you know, and at the end of the day, that's where the world needs to go to. The saving grace in all this is probably is AI and the ability of handling big data, not in my opinion, idiotic ChatGPT version, but in the ability to handle inside the scientific database that can actually improve it. We've seen it, as I alluded to before, we've seen in fusion energy where you now can control the plasma in terms of its stability. On top of that, inside the last 2 months, there's been research shown that now they even know every single atom there's in these plasma. So the scale that we are, you know, the time to the end goal of getting fusion energy or other alternative energy sources are getting close. I sit on a thing. I'm associated with a think tank in the UK, and the head of the commission that runs alternative energy, which is essentially is nuclear and fusion, told me they have promised. This is not me saying this. This is the high commissioner, so to speak, for this in the UK. They have told the British government they're going to put into the grid system by 2030 fusion energy. By 2035, they will be fully rolled out with security and the safety and everything else. And if you ask someone in the energy sector, they will say, oh, you said the same 50 years ago, 30 years and 20 years ago. Yeah, but the difference is all of the gains that's being made in science now is because of AI and big data handling. It's the data processing that is escalating massively in science, which makes biotech and AI science sort of the driver of that productivity goal I'm looking for.
That is massively important and interesting. And I also love that it's the part of the optimism in the story. And I'm just going to have to agree with you, Steen, that let's have you back on to talk about that with the time that it deserves. I'm looking at the time here. I know you got a hard break. And so I want to make sure we get clarity on some of these existing points before we let you go. But I do want to really acknowledge that is a massive opportunity. And that is one of the things when people say, well, hey, should we all just put our heads in the oven? It's like, no, there's good stuff coming. But if I can, let me get back to sort of how you see this year playing out. So if the rest of this quarter is following your, we'll call it pathway number one, it's all about the election. You say that, okay, well, in that case, then leveraged equity is going to do great. Basically, it's more of what we're seeing right now, right? It's the Mag 4, the Mag 7 continue to do really well. Credit spreads fall close to zero, which I'm sure makes a guy like you just, scratch his head in wonder to say, oh my gosh, with all the risks you see, how could credit spreads be that flat? But then as the wheels start to come off, perhaps, here's what you have, and I just would love for you to corroborate this. You say that the stock market could be down as much as 50%. So you're not just looking for a little wobble in the system here. You're looking for some pretty big losses. Energy and commodities become dirt cheap. You see that gold could actually really vault here. Maybe have a finally the year where it gets up to $3,000 an ounce. Soft commodities explode in price. The ECB and the Fed end up cutting by more than 250 basis points. You just mentioned that they're just going to have to get really aggressive here. And that inflation swaps hit a new low and then rally to a new norm of about 350 to 400 basis points. I imagine there too, you'd see credit spreads blow out in that scenario too, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, but I'm not calling. I mean, let me just be clear. I'm not calling for 50%. I'm saying in the worst case, it could be 50%. You
Okay.
know, the temptation would be to use the 2000 analogy and go for 90% in NASDAQ. But my point here is that when we try to handicap the future, we cannot try to figure out what will happen. What we need to handicap is what is the reaction function to X input. If X input is that the market drops 25%, you will see a massive amount of intervention, a massive. So getting to 50 is the real worst case, because I don't think anyone will allow it to happen in an election year. So you have this rubber band, Adam, at all times, where if it gets too far on the negative side, both the economy or the stock market, the rubber band will need to come back, because that's what the policymaker wants. So when you're trying to, and you can't, but when you're trying to sort of handicap the future, always think about what is the policy response instead of what is the consensus. The consensus is that Fed will stand by the side and be able and willing to help the market. Well, that's fine. But if the banking system, for instance, is undermined by its inability and its lack of capital, then, you know, making another bank facility lending program is not going to be enough. Then you actually need to, you know, do issue rights and making sure that they are capitalized at a better rate, right? So all of this is a decision tree, but getting to 50 is almost impossible in 24, in my opinion. I write it because, just, you know, people need to understand this is not a risk-free trade to just go all in on equities every single day. It has been since, you know, forever. But some of us actually were in the market before 98 and was in the market in 2000. You know, to me today, you know, I remember Yahoo. You remember, you probably remember, Adam. In 2000, Yahoo was the hottest stock in the world. I mean, it was
I
going to go
worked
to
at
like
Yahoo.
$1,000. Yeah, it was going
Sadly,
to go
not
to.
when it was the hottest stock in the world, but yeah.
It was the hottest stock in the world, and it went to $1. I mean, you know, I'm not saying I'm not going to find a specific stock to illustrate that with in the present market. I'm just telling you that the sort of the future is not a destined. It's path dependent, and that decision tree needs to be handicapped relative to the policy response. In 24, the policy response initially will be a very aggressive cutting of interest rate, because they have the validation through high real rates and a falling inflation. So when you have falling inflation doing nothing about the tightness that you have, you're actually increasing the tightening in an environment where you really want to be normalizing your tightening. That's going to be the excuse. The most likely event that will accelerate the move to the downside would be, you know, a banking crisis, illiquidity after March, when the bank lending program runs out, when you see bank lending net-net because of Basel III is reduced to year-over-year drawdowns of 5 to 6%. And all of a sudden, you're going to lose QT is going to be, you know, half probably, but they're still going to be doing, you know, 50 to 80 billion a month, taking money out of the market unless they stop it fully. Number two is going to be cutting QT altogether. And then we are back to where we used to be. We're going to have inflation below 2%, not sustainable, but we will have inflation below 2%, giving them additional room to cut interest rate further. So the policy response here is going to be, we are validated. We feel intellectually strong because we got inflation down. You know, whether the Fed got it down and it was just supply chains being solved by the private sector is a different story. But the case here is, for me, think about this as a rubber band and try to handicap the policy response, and then you get a much better matrix of the potential outcomes. The worst outcome I can see, if I put my trader brain on, is, you know, minus 15-20% before the reaction, and then what they do at the time and the ability of that to solve the situation at hand will dictate whether we go to 30% before we reverse. But the market cannot be down this year. We cannot have a recession this year, not only in the US, but also in the UK, in Belgium, in South Africa. All these places have a vested interest in keeping status quo. Status quo is the worst for the future, but status quo means that we are in the, you know, we started the year in the top of the ninth inning, and by the end of the year, if I'm right, we're going to be at the bottom. But this is not something to fear. It's just something to be prepared for, that there will be this, you know, forward and backward moves, two step forwards, three steps back, before we end the year. But underneath this sits, again, this productivity gains that, as it's rolled out in terms of the investment cycle in 25 and 26, will come to the rescue, reducing the burden on inflation, reducing the interest rate level that we need in the marketplace, and reducing the burden of the fiscal deficit that will be ever higher in terms of the nominal growth. We just need to make sure that the overall economy grows more than the debt grows. And that's where we have the problem right now. We are growing less than the debt. We need to get above the growth in debt.
And do you think we will? Because we've been growing debt more than GDP since I was born.
True. I mean, one exception. I mean, say what you want about Clinton years. Yeah, you had a little bit of a positive spell there with Rubin and Clinton. But yeah, it's been a bad story. And if you look at the CBO forecast, we are not going to have a single year between now and 2040 where the deficit in the U.S. is less than 7%. Less than 7%.
Which is crazy.
During the European debt crisis, we were after Italy for having debt to GDP of 120. Where is the US debt to GDP roughly today? Same level, right?
All right. Well, look, let me just get to the key questions here before I lose you. So you are a capital manager, Steen. You have to navigate your client capital through this turbulent year ahead that you see. How are you currently allocated?
50%. I have 25, 25, 25, 25. I have 4 times 25. Normally my bench is 25 equity, 25 fixed income, 25% commodity related, and 25% cash or private equity and sort of alternatives. Right now I have a total of 50% in equities, mostly in 2 to 5 years where it's pretty difficult to lose money, in my opinion. And then I still have 25% in equity, but I've tilted it towards nuclear power, semiconductors.
Okay, hey, I'm sorry. Can you go back? You're 50% what?
In fixed income.
Fixed income. Okay, I think you might have said equity, which is why I just wanted to.
No. Sorry about that. Fixed income. So I think, you know, in a year where I'm going to be punched a lot in the stomach, I'm just going to sit around getting the carry. So I'm in, you know, short-term money market funds. I'm in 2-year papers across the globe. I have 2-year Germany, 2-year UK, 2-year US. I have some 10 years. I have some Scandinavian mortgages because, you know, Denmark has zero inflation and a current account surplus of 11% to GDP. I mean, so and they're paying me 5% to do that in a hard currency, right? So not unlike the some of the other alternatives. So 50% in fixed income, 25% still in equity. But normally in equity, I'm not pretending that I know what will happen. But this time around, I've sort of increased my exposure to nuclear power, defense spending, semiconductors, and big cap stocks. So I'm sort of, you know, normally I just take the index or the MSCI World, but this time I'm actually going after this sort of specific themes inside equity. And then I have in commodities, I have 25%. I have 15% in gold and 10% in one of the funds, you know, the DBA, the Invesco commodity, which have yield carry. Because although commodities done very poorly, relatively speaking, you have a huge amount of carry in this because you have backwardation, because of supply demand being out of whack. If there is a little bit of, you know, net growth coming back or a little bit of inertia in the market, it will do well. So the expected return for a portfolio like that over periods of time is 6 to 7% with a sharp close to 1. And just for the record, having no view on the market, which is essentially what I have, 25, 25, 25, has been 80% of all active fund managers.
That's been 80% forever.
Yeah. So just keeping the 24 times 25 brackets keeps you, you know, net the biggest loss a month seen is 8% over the course of the last 20 years.
Wow. Staggering. I know you and I have talked about the impressive performance of that allocation in the past. All right. Well, look, we only have a couple of minutes left here, Steen. First question. For folks that have really enjoyed this conversation, would like to follow you and your work, where can they go?
So Saxo has a research page, which is free, which is called analysis.saxo. feel free to follow it. They are much, much smarter people than me on that website, but I do write the contribution that you were just referring to. I write once in a while notes there, so that's the way to go. Or you know, feel free to contact me on LinkedIn, of course.
All right, Stan. And when I edit this video, I will put up the links to your website and your LinkedIn there, so folks know where to go. All right. Well, just in wrapping up, folks, if you've enjoyed this conversation with Stan, would like to see him come back on the program, especially to discuss all the topics that we didn't get a chance to address here, please vote your support for that by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Just want to remind folks, too, that Thoughtful Money's spring conference is still coming up. That's going to be Saturday, March 16th. The early bird price is still in effect for that. So if you want to go lock that in, go to thoughtfulmoney.com/conference and lock in that lowest early bird price discount. And remember, if you're a premium subscriber to our Substack, you'll get an additional $50 off of the conference. So if you're not a subscriber to the Substack, go do so now. It only costs 15 bucks a month. You're totally welcome to game the system. Pay the 15 bucks to become a premium subscriber to get 50 bucks off of the seminar, off the conference. And don't worry if you can't watch live on Saturday, March 16th, because we will be sending replay videos of the entire event out to everybody within 24 hours of it being over. So you can watch those replay videos to your heart's delight. Just a reminder for folks, very challenging year, as Stan did a great job of elaborating here. If you're a regular person feeling overwhelmed about how to navigate your capital safely through what may lie ahead, highly recommend that you work under the guidance of a good professional financial advisor who takes into account the macro issues that Stan and I talked about here. And when you put that requirement onto the field, the percentage of good financial advisors out there that do all that really does shrink. If you've got one of them who's working well for you, great, stick with them. But if you don't, consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that Thoughtful Money endorses. To do that, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com. These conversations are free. There's no commitment to work with these guys. They just want to help as many people as possible, position as prudently as possible in advance. All right. And with that, Stan, last question. You and I have been talking a lot about money and financially related topics here. What's one non-money related investment that you would encourage people to consider adopting in their lives?
Empathy.
Great.
So I've been, you know, I'm getting old. I'm thinking a lot about life, and you know, I'm often in business meeting, or unfortunately, once in a while, I get dragged into a cocktail event. And I've noticed that very often the smartest person in the room is not the most aggressive. It's not the one that talks the loudest, but the one that shows the biggest empathy. And in a world where everyone is trying to blame, where politically, as we discussed, people wants to come with a strong voice, I think the smartest person in any room, in any family, is the one that shows the biggest amount of empathy, because that shows you that the person is able to rise above himself, his self-interest, and becoming part of something which is bigger and something which is, in my opinion, pretty beautiful if you can achieve that.
Well said. There's lots of research that shows the people who are most successful in life are those that have very high, I think they call it EQ instead of IQ, but the emotional intelligence. And I think you really just put your finger on it there. And Stan, I can say, I know you weren't fishing for the compliment, but you're one of the most empathetic economists that I get the pleasure of talking to. So thank you.
Thank you, Adam. Thanks for having me.
It was a total pleasure. Thanks so much, Stan. You're welcome to come back on this channel anytime you like. I got a ton of questions we didn't get to, especially the whole nuclear part. So we'd love to talk to you about that whenever you have time. Thanks for giving us your all like you always do. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.